Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, South Bay Live Music, on May 21st, 2018. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here on the South Bay of Los Angeles, and it's a beautiful place to listen to live music. This show is brought to you by Masternode Consulting, a cryptocurrency company. The world of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency today is very scary and new, and yet many people view it as the future and would like to invest safely and wisely. You can buy digital coins and hold them, or HODL, H-O-D-L as it's called, or you could participate in an ICO, an initial coin offering, but many of these are ill-conceived, and picking it and choosing those that make sense from those that don't is difficult. Then there is the world of masternodes, where without the expense of traditional proof-of-work mining, you can have the blockchain pay you directly whenever new coins are minted. We believe this is the best possible way to prosper in the blockchain and digital asset world. For more information, visit their website, masternodeconsulting.com. That's M-A-S-T-E-R-N-O-D-E, Masternode, masternodeconsulting.com. Or call 310-379-9822. That's 310-379-9822. Today, we welcome the Beach City Symphony, music director Barry Brisk. Barry Brisk first conducted in public at the age of 14 when he performed selections from South Pacific at his graduation from Webster Junior High School in West Los Angeles. As a student, he also conducted the orchestras at University High School, Mount St. Mary's College, and the University of Music, formerly Academy of Music, in Vienna, Austria, where he studied with the prominent conductor teacher Hans Swarovski. I'm going to get that right, Barry, soon. Professionally, Barry has conducted many orchestras in Southern California, as well as in Mexico and Austria. Maestro Brisk has been music director of the Beach City Symphony since 1994 and is particularly proud of having expanded the orchestra's repertoire. Barry Brisk's pre-concert lecture is at 7:15 p.m., The concert is free this coming Friday, May 25th. The concert is free. Parking is $3. If you bring three $1 bills, that'll make it easier to manage the parking kiosks in the parking lot at El Camino College, where the Marseille Auditorium is, and that's the location of the performance on Friday. Today, we're talking artists of the future. And Barry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's always a pleasure, Barry. I always look forward to these shows, catching up with you personally, and also just catching up with the beat of music, classical music here in the South Bay. How is the orchestra doing, or the symphony doing?
Oh, very well. Our last concert, which was a little bit on the challenging side because we had a very difficult piece, the Ravel Daphnis and Chloe Suite Number 2 and whatnot, went particularly well. So musically, we are doing very well right now. And other aspects like financial things, we're doing just fine. One could always do better there, you know, with any nonprofit.
Yes.
But musically, we're in great shape right now.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, Barry. I'm going to ask my standard question that I always ask, and I want to make sure that people know that the website for the Beach Cities Symphony is beachcitiessymphony.com. .org, is that right? And it's
correct.
Two
yes.
S's.
Mm-hmm. That's
Beach City
also
Symphony.
Correct,
and
yes.
Two S's. Right. And so tell me, Barry, is the Beach City Symphony, if you were describing this to someone who had never heard about it before, what is it?
Well, it's a community orchestra which means that the bulk of the players, 90%, are community volunteers. They're not professional musicians. So some of them being the South Bay, we have a number of them who are engineers or, you know, or scientific people. We had a gentleman who was an astrophysicist. He's still in the orchestra, but he's retired from that profession now. We have, you know, people who work for the various firms, Northrop Grumman and whatnot, down there. We also have people who do other things for a living. And since we're dealing with non-professionals, they don't get paid. They do it for the love of it. musicians love their instruments. You like violins. You like looking at your own violin. You like it looking at other people's violins. You love just putting it under your chin and playing it. And that's true with all of the instruments, clarinets, trumpets, whatever. And then they love playing the music. Because that's one of the reasons we come together to do Beethoven or Wagner or whatever it is we're doing. And then they develop a social repertoire. I mean, the people who've been in the orchestra for over 25 years, they've, you know, we get to know people. It becomes before the rehearsal or during the break, people are talking and whatnot because they've become fond of each other over the years. So there's many aspects.
Yeah.
To a community orchestra, and then when we get close to the concert, we bring in a few professionals to help out where you need that, you know. So, but that's the nature of a community orchestra, and we are a particularly good community orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. We are uniquely lucky in that way. I mean, there aren't that many community orchestras, are there?
There are a few. If you Southern California is a huge area. So if you were thinking of Los Angeles County, there are quite a few actually, because Los Angeles County goes east to, you know, to the San Gabriel Valley and south to San Pedro and north up to Santa Clarita. So that's a huge area. You also get things that are sort of they're similar, what we would call college community orchestras. For instance, El Camino College, where we perform, has such a thing under Dr. Dane Teeter, where they have students there, and it's and the orchestra is filled out with community personnel. And so a number of community colleges have such college community orchestras. So there's a certain amount of activity in this area.
Okay. Well, I'm thrilled that we have this in our area. It's so convenient living here in either Hermosa or Redondo or Manhattan Beach or Gardena or Lawndale or Torrance. It takes literally minutes for us to travel to El Camino College. Parking is very convenient and always very plentiful. You just need three $1 bills to manage the parking kiosks, and it's very easy. And then you're presented with a free concert. What a deal. And this is happening this coming Friday, the 25th, and it's Artists of the Future. Tell me a little bit about the concept for this particular performance.
All right. There's an organization in California called the Music Teachers Association of California, and it's all over the state. In Southern California, there are a number of branches. There's the West San Fernando Valley and the East San Fernando Valley in Glendale. And for what affects us here is the South Bay branch. They put on a contest to select soloists. And so this contest takes place at the end of January. And so they usually pick four soloists judges are brought in to handle that. And we have an arrangement with them that we will take their soloists on our May concert. So somewhere in the beginning of February, I get an email which tells me the names of the soloists and what they're going to play. And that's how
mm-hmm.
they're there. So they have to, their teachers have to be members of the South Bay branch of the Music Teachers Association of California. And this has worked quite well. I've already met the four students who are going to play this time. And in the past, they've always been very competent. Sometimes, you know, human nature, you get students who are brilliant. Sometimes you get students
mm-hmm.
who do very well, you know. But they're
mm-hmm.
all always prepared, you know. They
mm-hmm.
come on, they know what they're doing. I will admit that a number of years ago we had a student who sort of forgot a little bit in the middle of the performance, but then caught on and without stopping got back into it and we finished the piece. But, you know, you're dealing with...
Okay.
Sometimes we have had some who are as young as 8 and 9, and
right.
They can't be more than 18 or still in high school. They cannot be college
mm-hmm.
age. We have, there's a whole bunch of rules and regulations concerning this. But mostly they tend to be in the, you know, between, let's say, 13 and 16, which is what we have now. Although I haven't asked them their ages, just from looking at them, I'm guessing they're between 13 and 16. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two pianists and two violinists. They've already rehearsed with us, and they will be rehearsing with us again this week, and everything
mm-hmm.
will be going smoothly by our concert on Friday.
I assume these are pieces that either the child artist or their teacher has chosen, something that they've been working on, something that they
love. Oh, yes,
love
they have
doing.
To have worked on it because they had to have had it perfected by last January. So this is no last-minute thing. And whether the child said, I want to do this, I don't know. I would guess when you're of this age, you know, teenagers, usually the teacher says, well, it's time now to do the Beethoven Third Piano Concerto. You're ready for that, or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. So I think most
mm-hmm.
of the time it's the teacher making the suggestion.
Now, Barry, where are we in the journey for a musician? Because most people that attend this event this coming Friday, and I hope everyone listening will attend this coming Friday, these children are, as you said, anywhere between 13 and 16. They are, if there's any... if there's any coincidence or continuity with past performances, past years, some of these performers, soloists, are going to be brilliant. Are they at the, I don't know, are they going to Juilliard's and other schools like this? Where are they in their career? Because they're obviously fantastic musicians. I mean, if they wanted to play in any popular music band, they could be stars. So they're going for the classical. I mean, there's that issue that, you know, they're fantastic musicians, but there aren't that many spaces for a classical violinist, are there?
Well, there's a fair amount if you think of orchestras. Now, if you think of something being a soloist like Itzhak Perlman, there are not a whole lot of people who have that kind of a brilliant career at any one given time. But
right.
a lot of these people do not pursue music as a profession. They've learned it very
right.
well. They may continue doing it in college. And then they go into finance or the sciences or something else, but they just enjoyed doing this.
Right.
You know, I know of a couple of them who have gone to Juilliard. One of them
mm-hmm.
Is living in the South Bay now, and she plays occasionally with orchestras. She'll be playing with us next year and teaches. I can think of another couple that are in Juilliard right now who are going into the master's program
okay.
there, and I don't know exactly
okay.
what it is, but see, a musical career in the classical world can be isn't necessarily a simple thing. People put together a life, a musical life by playing here, teaching there. They may have a job at, let's say, a college or university teaching a clarinet, but that's not full time. So they also play in an orchestra or two somewhere. They give private lessons. They may be invited somewhere to hold a seminar out of town and things like that. So it isn't that you just become a soloist on your instrument. You know, it's a little more complex than that.
Yes. I thought that there might be some story there, because it's an amazing thing when you see these performers at your typical, the LA Phil or something like that, and you think what each one of these performers has a life story that's got to be fascinating, because they've met some of the finest teachers in the world. They've been to some of the finest schools in the world teaching music. And it's like an all-star performance every time you go to L.A. Phil. It's just...
Well, that's the thing about going to one of the major orchestras, is there you're getting the cream of the crop. You know, they're the ones who have made it. Not everybody is lucky. You know, you can have two people, let's say two violinists, who are talented, have worked equally hard, have both had wonderful teachers, and one of them has luck and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, that's also true in pop arts as well, you know.
Yeah. Yes. Now, we're having a wonderful time and a wonderful discussion, ladies and gentlemen, but it's time to listen to some music, to some classical music. Barry, we have several selections today. I wonder if you can be our guide. Which piece would you like to start with?
Let's see. Why don't we start with the Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto number 2, the third movement. If you can get I don't know if you have the third movement there.
Oh no, I'm sorry. We should coordinate this better.
Oh,
yes,
I do. Okay, so you have the first movement of that concerto?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
I actually have the entire concerto.
Let's go for a little bit of that. Okay.
It's just that I can't pinpoint the third movement.
Ah, okay.
So,
play it from the beginning and we'll listen to some of the first movement.
Okay. You want to preface this? This is the Camille Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto number 2 in G minor. Where does this stand in the Saint-Saëns?
He wrote five concertos, and this is his most popular one. Kind of interesting in the fact that the first movement is the slow movement. Usually that's reserved for the second movement, and the second and third movements are quicker. The one we will be playing is a presto, and it goes along rather rapidly. But the one we'll listen to is very sort of heavy, slow, and not meaning to be negative, but it's a little bit ponderous. And also his third violin concerto is very popular. His Carnival of the Animals for two pianos and small orchestras is very popular. So this is one of his big pieces.
Okay. Piano Concerto number 2 in G minor, Camille Saint-Saëns. And
thank you.
beautiful piece. Beautiful piece.
Oh, yeah, it's very dramatic, the part you just played, right?
I'm looking forward to seeing this piano soloist do this piece because it is so dramatic.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Wonderful.
Right.
Oh, but he's going to play the third movement. Is that true?
Right. The third movement is very quick. It just bounces right. It's the opposite of this movement. It's not you know, dramatic in that sense. It just rushes right along.
Right. So now, you've had one rehearsal with these students?
So far, yes, I've had one rehearsal, but then we have two rehearsals this week. So they will have been with the orchestra for three rehearsals before the concert. That's the way we've always done
it. Yes. And I know there's many, probably many stories about rehearsals from past, but how did the first rehearsal go with these four individuals?
Well, I mean, it takes a while to get used to each other, and some of them being the age they are have probably never worked with a conductor before. So you have to get used to how that all happens, you know, the starts and the stops and, you know, things of that nature. And maybe they're taking too many freedoms with the tempi that don't work well, that, you know, with the orchestra. So you work it out. Sometimes their teachers are present to make suggestions. Sometimes, so far we've only had one teacher at one rehearsal, but the teachers usually know me, so they know I'm competent, and there won't be any, you know, issues going on, because I'm particularly friendly with the students, because this is their first time. They're probably nervous, you know, and they're teenagers, and I'm a senior, you know, so that you don't want to frighten them.
You're not going to yell at them.
I don't yell at anybody. But you don't give them a nasty frown or anything. You know, pat them on the back and smile at them and make some little joke as it may come around, you know, to keep everybody happy, you know.
Yeah.
So you need to make these people, well, you do it with adult soloists who are very mature as well. You want to have a cordial relationship. You don't want to, you know, have a battle and then at the performance, everybody is uptight. You want to have everybody relaxed, psychologically relaxed, so that you can come to the fore when doing these difficult things. You know, so that's the way I tend to handle it.
Right. Okay. Well, this is fascinating. I love this.
While we're still on the subject of the Saint-Saëns Concerto, I want to mention that the young man who will be playing that is Nathan Kim.
Yes. And he will be, I think this is going to be a great evening for him. If he hasn't had a great deal of experience performing with an orchestra, this should be a wonderful experience. So, who's next?
Who's next? Well, why don't we go to the Samuel Barber Violin Concerto?
Okay. Now, next time we will communicate on this. I'm sorry, there was a little mix-up in getting these pieces.
Yes, but that's
only for the
Saint-Saëns, because the Saint-Saëns is the only one that is doing the third movement. The other three concertos are doing first movement, so you can start at the beginning.
Oh, I see. Samuel Barber. Tell us a little bit about this violin concerto.
Oh, well, let's see. Samuel Barber, with that name, was obviously an American composer. He was very prominent from an early age. He wrote this around 1937. He was hired to write it by a wealthy man who commissioned it for his son. The son, who was not a professional, thought it was too difficult, so they had to get out of they had to make arrangements for somebody else to play it. And at the first professional performance, which was, I think, in 1941, with the Philadelphia Orchestra, with conducted by Eugene Ormandy. The soloist was an American violinist by the name of Albert Spaulding, who had a reasonable reputation back then, but not huge. I mean, this was the era when Jascha Heifetz was the giant among violinists. But Spaulding, if the name sounds familiar from some other field, there are Spaulding sports equipment, basketballs,
right.
And I'm not sure about baseballs, but things of that nature. And he was the scion of that family. So just a little side event. It's got nothing to do with the concerto, but it's just a little thing to point out about that soloist. And it was successful from the beginning. So it gets played a fair amount. Barber, of course, is most famous for his Adagio for Strings, which is, not exactly a sad piece of music, but a very thoughtful kind of a thing, which was played a great deal after the 9/11 tragedy. So one tends to think of it in sort of tragic terms, but it's actually the slow movement of his string quartet. Then he slightly altered it to be played by string orchestras, and I believe Toscanini introduced that when he was quite old in the late 40s. So Barber also was commissioned in the 60s to write the opera that would open up the new Metropolitan Opera House in New York. And everybody was slightly surprised, and we had an American composer, an American opera house. They thought or hoped he would pick an American subject for the opera, but he didn't. He went back to antiquity and wrote an opera based on the story of Anthony and Cleopatra. So that was one thing, and it was not exactly a resounding success. That opera gets played every so often somewhere, but it never really made it big. But that's the way things go. The Metropolitan Opera House is a wonderful place, and they do all kinds of marvelous operas, the standard repertoire as well as new things and whatnot. So he did inaugurate that opera house.
Okay. That is a good piece of classical music history.
Yes.
Samuel Barber. Yes, it is. And his violin concerto, Opus 14. Samuel Barber. Here we go.
Thank you.
Well, here we are. We're back. Samuel Barber. I don't know, Barry, but I think I can detect an Americanism in that piece.
Oh,
I don't know how you do that. Can you? Is that real or am I imagining?
Oh, no, you listen to music by Aaron Copland or Leonard Bernstein, who all knew each other. Definitely American. You would never say that it was German or Russian or anything like that. How you do that, I'm not entirely sure, you can tell that.
Yeah. There is definitely something there. It's not the standard themes and or attitude and or strategy and or whatever else you can throw in there that you would hear in another piece isn't there. It's fresher, and there's something
right. So, do you have a sample there from my serenade?
Well, Mr. Brisk, there is one of the pieces is more important than the others. We're talking, ladies and gentlemen, about a serenade composed by our very own music director, Barry Brisk. Barry, tell us about this serenade. How did it come about?
The reason I mentioned that is when I played that for a friend of mine many years ago, he said, "Oh, that's influenced by Copland." And I wasn't thinking of Copland at all at the time I was writing it. But you see, it's sort of an American kind of a style. But this all came about in 2005. My wife and I were in the Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado hiking. We used to do a lot of hiking. And if you've done much hiking, you're slogging around on a trail, looking at your feet, making sure you don't fall. But you can also, when paths clear up, you can let your mind wander. And I started thinking about a composition, writing something. And I had an idea for a four movement sort of a thing featuring four different emotions. And so when we got back to the motel after the hike, I started writing, not music, but writing it down with words. And eventually I started working it out with these emotions, and I began thinking of artworks that would have expressed these four different emotions. And I mentioned this to a colleague of mine, and so he immediately said, "Oh, pictures at an exhibition." I figured, everybody's going to say that. So I had to scrap the title, not the music, but the titles I had, and all references to artworks. So now it's just, different emotions there. So I wrote the four movements, and then I realized you can't just sort of start on it. I wrote a little introductory first movement, and then I wrote a finale, so that at the end, to end the piece. But the finale, one of my little ideas, doesn't have any new material. It's all taken from the previous five movements and tosses the stuff around. So you may have a theme going from the third movement accompanied by something from the fifth movement or whatnot. So I just played around with everything. There are things that sound like they're new, but they're really variations of something from a previous movement, some chord structure or something of that. The Beach City Symphony did the world premiere of this in 2007. That was 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the Topanga Symphony played it about 6 years ago. I don't remember exactly the year. So this will be the third performance of the piece. It was written with the Beach City Symphony in mind, with its capabilities and whatnot. So that piece is what opens the program today.
Yes. Well, let's give a listen to Serenade. Barry Brisk. All right. Marvelous. And we did get into
whole,
the second movement there.
Exactly. We got into halfway through the second movement. The whole piece is perhaps 20 minutes long. As symphonies and things like that go, it's not a huge thing, but it goes. Yes. So the orchestra
fresh.
Well, the orchestra has played about four of my compositions. We did a big orchestra piece called Kaleidoscope, and then a few years ago we did a thing. I composed a thing for my 20th anniversary as music director. Called Celebration, and then we played my much older trombone concerto, Concerto for Trombone and Strings, which goes back to 1984. So we've done four of my pieces now, and this is a repetition of one of them.
Well, a very nice piece, and I see where the comparison to Copland comes from. And the beginning, very dramatic and interesting there. And well, thank you for that, Barry. That's wonderful. We're going to hear a piece by the opening to the concert will be the serenade piece. Then we'll have the four soloists, Phoebe Cao, Nathan Kim, Chen Chin Liu, and Allison Park, with their respective pieces. And then the last piece of the evening will be Wagner's Flying Dutchman Overture, which is always wonderful to hear.
Oh, yes, it's
so,
a great piece.
No doubt about that. We have 13 minutes left. What piece would you like to play next?
Let's do a little bit of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto.
Let's do a little bit of it. Mendelssohn. And we're talking, here we go. A violin concerto E minor. All right, here we go.
Thank you.
beautiful piece. I know people are going to love that.
Oh, yes. Well, it's one of the most famous violin concertos in the repertoire. Right.
Yes.
And that's going to be played by Phoebe Cao.
Just
so we get all of that.
Yes.
Right. So next we should probably go to the Rachmaninoff concerto.
All right. All right.
The Rachmaninoff concerto number 2 for piano. Right.
So where does this stand in Rachmaninoff's pantheon of music?
Oh, it's his most popular piece. That concerto, and then the third concerto, and the Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini. But this is played more than anything else by him. It used to be that when we had more piano recitals, his Prelude in C sharp minor was played to death, but because it was played so much. But we don't have too many piano recitals anymore, and perhaps pianists grew tired of playing that piece. But this is by all stretches of the imagination his most popular work, and as we'll hear in a moment, perfectly good reasons why. It's a wonderful piece.
Okay. Here we go. Sergei Rachmaninoff. Well, I got lost in that piece. That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It's very famous. It's very easy to get lost in it, all the wonderful melodies he came up with for that.
Yeah, yeah. And what's left?
Oh, yes. No, well, first I want to get in there that our soloist for that will be Chen Chen Lu. Okay.
Yes.
So all we have left now is the Flying Dutchman Overture by Wagner.
All we have left now.
Right.
And
which,
yes.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I please tell us about the Flying Dutchman Overture.
Oh, well, okay. He said in his own autobiographical sketch that he took the story from the famous author Heinrich Heine's retelling of the legend and he wrote this in an 1833 satirical novel, The Memoirs of Mr. von Schnabelowopski, which is, of course, a silly name. But the story is in there, and it's basically about redemption. The Dutchman has been condemned to go to stay at sea on a ship. That's not exactly a magical ship, but he's the only person on the ship. And once every 7 years, it lands in a port. And if someone can basically, a woman, give themselves to him, then he can finally die instead of existing for hundreds of years. And finally, as the story goes, there's a young lady there who has seen a picture or a painting of this mythical Flying Dutchman. And she's intrigued by it. And so when his ship arrives and they find out what it is, she goes for him, not in a romantic sense or anything sensuous, but she just sort of believes in him and just, in the end, just dies for him. And in most opera productions, at that point, at the end, you just sort of see something, perhaps just lights, going up to the heavens. He has been redeemed, and he's now no longer impelled to sail the waves. He can now find rest. So that's in general the story. To fill up a 3-hour opera, you know, there's a lot more detail in there, but we don't need all that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. is this, Wagner has, you know, many, many, many pieces that are very famous. I mean, obviously The Ring and everything. But how does this stand up in the Wagner pantheon?
Oh, well, of course, The Ring and Parsifal and Meistersinger are perhaps get done a little bit more often, but this is up there. His 10 big operas or whatever it is are all pretty much on a plane. You know, this and Tannhäuser and Lohengrin get done quite a bit. Even they're very challenging. They're very long. He never wrote a short opera. They're all played all over the world all the time. Yes. And, of course, when you hear The Flying Dutchman, since it is about a ship at sea and all that, the overture just starts with a storm at sea. I mean, it's sort of, you can't quite miss it, you know. Yes.
Right, right. Fantastic. Let's hear a bit of it before we conclude. This is Richard Wagner. I have to get back into position. The Flying Dutchman Overture. Thank you. Flying Dutchman.
Right, very dramatic and, you know, turbulent. Going with most of Wagner's stories are very turbulent.
Yes. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, I do not want you to forget that we have this coming Friday, the 25th of May, the Music Teachers Association of California South Bay Branch, Artists of the Future, performing at the Marseille Auditorium, the Beach City Symphony Orchestra. It's going to be fantastic. The pre-concert lecture starts at 7:15. Maestro Brisk will be there at 7:15 giving the pre-concert lecture, and then the performance starts at 8 p.m. Parking is $3. Bring $3 $1 bills. That makes it very easy to park, and we're looking forward for all of you to come. The concert, of course, is free, so we hope that you can make it. Anything else, Barry? Did I leave out anything?
I think we've covered it for this time.
I think we have, and what a wonderful lineup to this time. It's going to be fantastic. Now, is this the third or the end of the season? The MTAC
series. No, this is the
series.
Fourth and final concert of the season. The next concert doesn't happen until next October.
Next October. Okay.
Right.
So it's been quite a season, Barry. Quite wonderful. Looking forward to the next season. Thank you for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you. And This is a wonderful opportunity, ladies and gentlemen. Invite a friend. Invite someone in the South Bay who's never been to the Beach Cities Symphony. I guarantee you they're going to be hooked for life. It's such an amenity living here in the South Bay. It's easy, it's cheap, and it's wonderful. So I hope to see you there. Thanks, Barry. We'll see you there on Friday. Talk to you soon. All right. Bye-bye, Barry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.